Welcome to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. We're living in unprecedented times. Long-held institutions, including the media, are being upended, and there are concerns about the future of our democracy. While it may sound hyperbolic, step three of the fascist playbook says, discredit all media and reinforce the idea that yours is the only true word that can be trusted. It's an institution that some are concerned is becoming all too real, that instruction. We're talking about the media landscape this hour. Danny Kimball is associate professor and chair of media arts and studies at Goucher College in Baltimore and joins us now. Welcome back to All Sides, Danny.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So how do you feel as a media professor? Is it difficult to teach with all of these media disruptions taking place right now?
It definitely is.
Is it more fun? Does it make it more fun to teach?
Well, it's a certain kind of fun. I wouldn't exactly describe what's going on in the world right now as fun, but it is makes for a lot of good discussions to try to keep up with and make sense of all of the things changing in our media and in our world. Absolutely.
So when you think about the media breakdown that's going on right now, you know, all of the increased disinformation that's been spread, especially in recent years, what concerns you the most?
Yeah, I think what concerns me the most is related to how you opened the show, exactly, that our media is another of the many failed democratic institutions and systems, and that unfortunately leaves us to fend for ourselves as individuals that, you know, with the loss of traditional legacy news media that has a certain standard of reliability, all of us are left to sort of be journalists ourselves. That journalism is a discipline of verification, and we are sort of left to do that, corroborating what we see and what we can trust on our own. And that makes for an environment where a deliberate spread of disinformation and propaganda is absolutely a front in rising authoritarianism and rising fascism.
Now, when you say we have to be journalists ourselves, that's pretty scary because, you know, most people are not trained at that or good at that or able to figure out truth from fiction because they're all on social media looking at an algorithm specifically designed for them. What do you make of the way social media has influenced people's opinions?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the context this needs to be understood in, is that a lot of the traditional gatekeepers of the legacy news media have not gone away. There's I think what's happened is that the gatekeepers have changed to the algorithms run by big tech companies and social media platforms that are filtering what we see, not based on you know, the information that we need to have a democracy and what information people need in their lives, the sort of decisions that used to be the editorial judgments of newspapers and television and radio broadcasters, but instead algorithms that are optimized for engagement, as the tech companies say. What's the content that's going to keep our attention? And that's the number one priority, is capturing that and holding that attention. And that makes for the, again, the type of environment where, you know, there's no distinction between truth or fiction or information or entertainment or news or propaganda. It's all just content. Mm. And does that content keep our attention or not? That's all the algorithms do. And that's all that the tech companies that are currently in control of our information environment care about.
Now, heading into the 2024 election, I read an editorial somewhere, I can't remember where it said that the firewall, like having to pay for news from a lot of newspapers, was a part of the problem. Like they were blaming a part of all of the disinformation and why everything with the election was blowing up so, and no one knew what was true and there were so many lies, they blamed firewalls. So how does a newspaper stay afloat if they give the information away for free without subscribers, right?
Yeah. This really is the conundrum of it all, that it, I think it does contribute to a news media environment where if the information that's available for free is the unreliable stuff that we don't know easily what's true or what's not without, as you said, an extensive education in how to be a journalist, that the most high quality, reliable journalism is behind a paywall, that doesn't help our democracy. But at the same time, how are these news outlets going to survive without revenue? And this actually, I think, points to the deeper structural issue that's underneath a lot of this, I think doesn't get talked about enough. And that's that all of these crucial democratic functions of the news media are largely reliant on a for-profit commercial media model that either needs paid subscribers or especially advertising-based revenue. That's part of what I think is so important about public broadcasters. Not just sucking up to you here, Amy. I think is a very important role for public radio and public media in general. But it makes it tough to count on news and information coming from especially a for-profit system that needs to be able to compete in this kind of information environment.
Yeah, the plug for public radio. So public radio and public television are mostly funded by listener and viewer support, a listener giving in whatever amount they feel is fair. And we do, in return, we do not have advertisers. We don't have shareholders, so we're not beholden to them. But we do have membership drives, so we have to come on the air and ask people to give. Not every newspaper can do that, and not every newspaper has a radio station and a TV station with which to broadcast to ask for people to support it. So, I'm not saying I want anyone to steal our funding model, but it's not a funding model that can work everywhere. That's why advertising, if you like, if you think of like holding a newspaper 30 years ago, it was full of ads, right?
And I think that that's what's led to the collapse of legacy media is that advertising-based business model has been eaten by the big tech companies that have essentially a monopoly over advertising at this point. Companies like Google and Meta that dominate the digital advertising market have eaten up all those revenues that, local newspapers or local broadcasters used to be able to count on. And so now they're left having to put their content on the same platforms owned by those companies that they get the advertising revenue, not the people creating the content. And then you're left playing the same sort of attention economy game against, as I said, all sorts of other content that's measured by attention and engagement and not, the public interest and what the people need. And that's a tough game to play when you're essentially playing Donald Trump and Elon Musk's game of the attention economy, and you're playing by their rules.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about recent changes in the media landscape with Danny Kimball, an associate professor and chair of media arts and studies at Goucher College in Baltimore. So you, Elon Musk, even Elon Musk has admitted that he won't be giving out correct information, and it's up to the press to correct him. What do we do with that?
I mean, that's a certain amount of transparency there to just not trust what they say, and then to know that in this sort of social media environment where people are getting news and information from sources like Elon Musk and him personally, and also his formerly known as Twitter platform now called X, that the algorithms there are tweaked and gamed to favor the sort of voices that Elon Musk is supporting, and these are places where it's all the more important to have the role of journalism as in a democracy, the necessary process of finding and telling the truth that journalists role is to give us the information that we need to live in a democracy. And that includes straight news reporting, just the facts to tell us what's happening in the world. We need a certain shared reality to be able to operate from. But that also means adversarial investigative journalism that stands up and speaks truth to power on behalf of the people and digs into things that are deliberately hidden from us, and will take stances and make arguments for the truth through commentary and analysis and opinion journalism that's independent from censorship, whether it's, oligarchic newspaper owners or corporate media conglomerates or government censorship or pressure. I think that's an important role that journalism needs to play.
You just listed some important roles journalism needs to play, but how do journalists build trust? There's a lot of many longtime news people who are leaving the business because they just can't, they can't take it anymore. How do the journalists who remain build trust? How do they get people to trust them?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think that there has been a breakdown in trust between people and the media, and I think that a lot of it has to do with some of these larger structural issues. But I think that increasingly we're seeing journalists try to sort of either directly leave the institutions that you're at, like you're alluding to, people leaving newspapers and starting newsletters or podcasts or sort of go out on their own because they have an established audience and they have that sort of trust that they can bring that audience with them and sort of be able to go out on their own like that. But I think that's the sort of thing that can work for some big names and that have that established audience. But I don't know that it's a sustainable model for the media when again you're back to playing the sort of game of journalists needing to become quote unquote content creators or influencers in the same social media platforms that need to have that sort of audience engagement and audience trust, but then without the sort of institutional resources and backing and sort of entrepreneurial version of this, I don't know how sustainable that is for most journalists or most people doing this work.
Yeah, that's I was going to ask you about the blurred line between influencer and reporter. Where is there even a line to be found now? It's really hard to determine who is actually a journalist versus trying to be an influencer.
Yeah, I agree. It's a whole nother pressure that journalists and even artists and creators of all kinds feel, where they have to consider what they're doing as much about kind of cultivating and maintaining that audience, that community that you see, kind of that business model of the influencer being the sort of thing that journalists are forced to consider doing if they're going out on their own in this sort of quote unquote creator economy kind of model, that how much that becomes part of the work instead of the actual investigative reporting or even opinion and commentary that catering to that audience becomes part of those considerations too. And that does blur those lines between, what we see as a role of a traditional journalist and, another influencer or another content creator on the same platforms.
Now, I'm not sure how many years you've been a media studies professor. How long have you been in this field?
10 years.
10 years. So in those 10 years, have in that time and that you've been teaching your students, have their views of the news changed, the students?
Yeah, it's interesting because at this point, I think it has fully sort of shifted from there being a sense of different types of media, some medium specificity between journalism is different from other forms of media, to now, I kind of said this earlier, it's all just content. And not just to the young people in my classrooms, but I think to many media consumers now, that there isn't a distinction between types of media forms or the process that went into creating these things, but it's just content that's consumed on screens. And that's, I think, fully the way that the Gen Z students that I have in my classroom see the world. And I think that's sort of where everything has headed now. And I think that's it's something that to understand the current media landscape, that everything is just content on platforms, on screens. Unfortunately, what does that do to the important role of journalism in a democracy when it's all comes back to those same platform pressures of that are controlled by big tech companies?
Yeah. So do your students get their news from Instagram Reels and TikTok? If you had, if
Yes.
yes, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. TikTok is their main news source.
And do you tell them to check it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's
Do you tell them to
just like
check
we're
it twice?
This is an important part of these conversations is like learning how to know what to trust and how to corroborate and verify what you're seeing. And I think there are good things that can come with the increased sort of participation and diversity that comes from social media and many more people being able to create content and share it with the world. But it does come with a major risk of the loss of some of those sort of editorial processes that we should be able to count on to be able to combat misinformation and disinformation and propaganda that I think we're seeing more and more of now.
Well, when you figure out how to get your students to pay attention to public radio and maybe like the evening news programs or like CBS Sunday Morning or something, you come back and let me know.
All
Okay.
right, I'll let you know.
That was Danny Kimball, Associate Professor and Chair of Media Arts and Studies at Goucher College in Baltimore. Thank you for being here, Danny.
Thanks so much, Amy.
Coming up, we're gonna talk about the departure of longtime anchors and some declining ratings, and we'll continue talking about the changing media landscape. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Legendary newsman Walter Cronkite was once considered the most trusted man in America. Families once gathered around a television at dinner to watch him deliver the news of the day. Well, those days are long gone, and news sources people turn to, if at all, are as varied and partisan as the country itself. Since last year's election, news networks have seen the departure of many longtime anchors, and ratings have plummeted. Joining us now to talk about the changing media landscape is Jeremy Barr, media news reporter for The Washington Post. Welcome to All Sides, Jeremy.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
So let's begin with your employer, The Washington Post, making news recently about changes to the opinion section. Can you comment on Jeff Bezos' decision to make the section more focused on, quote, personal liberties and free markets?
I can probably comment over drinks sometime,
Right.
I think we're not entirely sure. Obviously, I can't speak for the Post. As a media reporter, I'm in a very awkward position where I'm sometimes asked to cover things involving the Post, and that's not an assignment anybody wants, no matter where they work. But we haven't really gotten a lot of clarity, I guess, of what that announcement meant. I mean, we have a bunch of columnists who cover things that are not entirely personal liberties and free markets. So I think there's confusion. I mean, confusion is sort of the optimal word for pretty much all the companies that I cover right now, TV networks, newspapers, both in terms of the business model and also, how to properly cover the current White House and how to deal with restrictions and everything else that's happening.
Yeah, what worries have you heard in your coverage from the Washington Post and other outlets? Like the Washington Post has seen a significant drop in subscriptions because of some things that Bezos has said with him at the helm.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the broader, if I can broaden it a bit, I think the broader question is how committed are TV networks, newspapers, magazines, to covering the Trump administration really critically and openly and honestly, and to not have any concerns about losing access. I mean, that's been true for every administration, but I do think with this one, we've obviously seen more restrictions on the press. I don't recall with the Biden administration, there were some concerns about access to, planes used by photographers and some other issues. And there's obviously a lot of critiques of Karine Jean-Pierre, the press secretary, for maybe not answering questions, and there was concerns about access to Biden. But obviously, the Trump administration really makes it a point to emphasize the media as a target, and has basically said that they're going to kind of continue, making limiting access, and sort of, I think, see what happens. So we're not really sure what's going to happen, but something seems to happen every week, I would say so far.
Right. Not every week, every day.
Right.
So you mentioned this because you were looking back between Trump administration and the Biden administration. Are the current media shakeups we're seeing, especially in the recent couple of weeks, are they attributed mostly to the Trump administration, or do you think that some of this was coming anyway, just with the way media has changed in the past 5 years?
I think that the changes in distribution and content and the way in which, YouTube stars and podcasters are becoming more influential in covering campaigns, I didn't really think that was going to actually sort of register as much in the White House press briefing situation. I mean, the White House press briefing room is a very traditionally focused operation with TV networks and newspapers and the AP and Reuters. And so, I mean, they did create this sort of additional new media seat that seems to go, so far has gone mostly to conservative outlets. But I didn't really expect the White House press briefing operation to change too much. I think no one expected them to change the poll process. That's just been a standard for so long, that didn't really even change the first Trump administration. So there was a lot of effort at, I think, many media companies to prepare for this administration. At every level, whether that was talking more about, the rights of legal rights of reporters, what happens if there's defamation suits, some of this access stuff, but it doesn't seem like people really anticipated that they would uproot the pool like this because it's just been such a mainstay, and it's kind of been like outside the scope of discussion about restricting access. So it's actually really confusing to even understand what's happening right now. I've just been asking some White House reporters about whether, so there was a memo last week, if I can just explain a little bit,
Yeah,
where the
explain a
White
little
House.
bit about what you mean
Sure.
whenever you say that he changed the pool.
Absolutely. So, I mean, the White House pool process essentially allows a smaller group of reporters to cover the White House on behalf of a lot more reporters. So there's kind of an in-house, in-town pool where they're, covering events in the White House, whether that's like an Oval Office event where, it might only allow 10 reporters, or some other larger events. There's an out-of-town pool that covers, when he goes to Mar-a-Lago. And so essentially, the White House began essentially deciding who gets to be in that actual pool. So normally, the White House Correspondents Association decides, here are the reporters who are in the pool today because it's done alphabetically. So everybody has the chance to be in the pool, and it rotates between outlets. Large outlets, small outlets, conservative outlets, more liberal outlets. And so the White House basically made this large announcement that actually now they are in charge of who gets to be in the pool. And there were some concerns among White House reporters that that meant they would sort of stack it with more Trump-friendly outlets. And we've already seen that they obviously excluded the Associated Press, which, that resulted in a lawsuit. They've also been cutting out Reuters, the wire service, which has been a longtime member of the pool. They added in a additional secondary TV slot, a new media slot. So the makeup of the pool is changing. And late last week, the White House Correspondents Association sent out a memo to its members, basically saying to the White House, if you want to run this process, go for it. But I don't really know exactly if the handover has happened yet. I think the sense is that they are starting to hand over some of the responsibilities. I mean, the job of covering the president and covering his movements is incredibly logistically challenging. I cover TV news, and people always emphasize to me that we don't talk enough about how hard it is to cover people and to schlep the TV equipment across the country and to fly in and to set up the audio. And so that costs media companies millions of dollars, which they shoulder that financial burden among each other because it's sort of a public service. So that's the big question, is whether the White House will actually start to pay for that whole process of getting people around the country and moving all the equipment that needs to be moved.
Yeah, so right now the news organizations, they just have an understanding and they all pay a fair share to fly to, because it costs a lot of money to fly all around everywhere the president is going. So it's not known if the White House is going to pay to bring these reporters along.
I think the idea is that it's going to change over time, but everything is moving quickly, and they're trying to cover the president in the pool as they're trying to figure out what the pool even is anymore. And so it's just this rapidly moving thing where I think even White House reporters don't even know right now what's going to happen exactly. There's a lot of behind the scenes negotiating between the White House Correspondents Association and the White House, so they don't always have information about what's actually happening behind the scenes, because I obviously the White House Correspondents Association did not want to have to take these sort of draconian step of saying, if you guys are going to control this, we're out, because they have this obligation to the readers and to the viewers, and they're always making these calculations about when do we take a stand, and by taking a stand, are we actually hurting the viewers and readers by not giving them the access that they need? So it's kind of this impossible situation where everybody's kind of upset and frustrated, which I guess is kind of explains how media works in general these days.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the changing media landscape with Jeremy Barr, media news reporter for The Washington Post. Now, you said you mostly cover TV, so we can get into TV a little bit. There's been some big changes. NBC Nightly News anchor Lester Holt has announced that he'll be stepping down later this year. CBS Evening News revamped its program, and there was after the departure of Nora O'Donnell from the anchor desk. Do it. I guess I was just talking with our last guest about how young people don't watch the evening news. So, what do you make of these changes with Lester Holt leaving and Nora O'Donnell?
I think that the sort of the behind the scenes explanation for a lot of these changes in TV news is normally money. You saw people like Hoda Kotb leave the Today Show, several different CNN anchors left. We're seeing a lot of movement out of these big networks. Neil Cavuto at Fox News has been there since like 1996, left Fox News. So the economics of the industry are changing, and I think TV networks are just paying people less money. And if you're an anchor who's used to being paid $18 million a year, getting cut down to $9 million a year while still a massive amount of money is almost not worth the effort, if that makes any sense. And so you are seeing a lot of people that maybe are later in the career decide they just don't want to do it anymore at that price point. You're seeing a lot of people switching to doing Substacks. Allison Camerota, who was a longtime CNN anchor, launched a Substack. Jim Acosta, another CNN anchor, launched a Substack. And these are, they are now sort of working directly with readers, where they are charging readers, $5, $10 a month to read their newsletters. And so you're seeing a movement away from traditional television by some personalities. But yeah, I mean, TV networks have been trying to figure out how to get young people to watch TV news for, I don't know, 40 years now. And I'm 37, and I don't know anybody who watches any of the evening news broadcasts. They're really good. I think they're really good summations of the news, but normally by 6:30, most people know what's actually going on that day and already got Twitter updates and Facebook updates and Instagram updates. And you don't really necessarily need a summation of what's going on. But if you actually watch it, I think it's a pretty useful educational product. But there's no way to get people to watch that. So that's why the average viewer on most cable networks and TV networks is in the high 60s, because that's sort of the basis. And it's just been challenging, and no one's really cracked the nut on how to actually get younger people to watch.
Another high-profile departure from MSNBC was host Joy Reid, whose show was canceled as a part of a network lineup change. She opened her final show with this question.
We begin tonight with what I think is the question. When you are in the midst of a crisis, and specifically a crisis of democracy, how do you resist? When fascism isn't just coming, it's already here. So what, if anything, can you do about it?
And over at CNN, daytime host Jim Acosta is an outspoken critic of the first Trump administration. He resigned rather than get moved to a graveyard shift. Let's listen.
I've always believed it's the job of the press to hold power to account. I've always tried to do that here at CNN, and I plan on going doing all of that in the future.
Do you think we'll see more high-profile departures besides Lester Holt and the ones that we've mentioned already?
We're actually seeing so many departures that essentially there aren't that many more super well-known broadcast anchors to leave. I mean, basically, the NBC and CBS nightly newscasts have been totally, you know, Lester leaving is a huge deal. CBS basically changing their format, and Norah O'Donnell leaving as host of that show and then bringing in two additional hosts. Those are two massive transitions there. I mean, you just see less of these kind of, obviously we don't really have Walter Cronkite-like figures anymore, but these big names that people trust and know, they're just kind of gradually fading away over time. And I think that that maybe even further creates this problem of lack of viewership. When people's favorite anchors are leaving, they have less reason to watch, certainly. And that's a big change to people's viewership patterns. I mean, it's really hard to get new viewers to any of these shows. And when you lose viewers, you don't get them back, essentially. So we have this dwindling number of people that keeps dropping a bit as the economics make it less feasible for them to, the anchors, to be paid $20 million a year. So it's just kind of going to continue, I think, to cycle down, unfortunately, over time. Meanwhile, we have this massive story to cover. There's restrictions on access. You know, you have some of these big TV networks that their parent companies want to make all these mergers and acquisitions, and they're concerned about how the Trump administration might see it. So you have all these different simultaneous trends that are putting pressure on media companies. And obviously, viewers are noticing as their favorite anchors are leaving, whether it's CNN or CBS or NBC.
Now, we mentioned the Associated Press a couple of times. They're taking legal action to try to restore the journalistic access at the White House. Do we have an update on that?
So I went to a hearing they held on Monday about that. Basically, the Associated Press asked for a temporary restraining order that would have returned their access to White House events on an interim basis, essentially, and that was denied. So they are still kicked out of different White House events right now. And the next hearing in the case is not until March 20th. So that means that they are out until at least March 20th. They're still trying to get an injunction to basically reverse this order quickly. But I mean, they say that every day that they can't cover these events is a disservice to their readers. Obviously, the Associated Press is read by millions of people when you aggregate all the different places that AP articles run, and they run around the world. And many sites, many local news sites, rely heavily on AP articles because they don't necessarily have the funding to be able to have all this original reporting. So there's a huge trickle-down effect when the AP is limited. But this case is going to move slowly right now. Just to go back a bit, so when Jim Acosta, we mentioned before, had his press pass taken away in 2018, I think it was, the judge did grant a restraining order, and Acosta got his press pass back immediately. The White House ended up actually dropping the entire thing, and it was sort of resolved within a few weeks. And so this is already being drawn out, I think, longer than that, and may go on for a long time more.
What have you heard from other news outlets? Are they supporting the AP, or is it kind of divided down the middle where some don't care? They say more room for me, and others are trying to come to the AP's defense.
I think we're seeing a lot of ideological unity on this. So Fox News and Newsmax, another conservative TV network, both signed a letter expressing their concern about this. And I think that all media companies have voiced their support for the AP. But the question is whether they can go beyond voicing support, because the White House seems pretty unmoved by statements of support and, you know, harshly written letters castigating them as, you know, attacking the First Amendment and the Constitution. So there's a bit of a question about whether they'll take any further collective action. But there's this huge roiling debate about, for example, if certain reporters just chose not to, certain outlets chose to not show up to the briefing room or not to be part of the pool anymore, not to cover the White House, not to cover Trump. They have to decide whether that would actually hurt their readers and their viewers. So there's these kind of short-term calculations being made and long-term calculations being made. I think many media companies are worried that this could sort of get even worse, and when should they take a stand? And they also don't want to seem too partisan. So if, you know, the AP, I think, did not want to file a lawsuit against the White House because they probably didn't want a headline saying that the AP is suing the White House, because mm-hmm. they want their readers certainly to trust their news, and they are kind of the gold standard of impartiality, I would say. So this kind of puts them in a bad spot. So my general thesis is everybody's in a bad spot right now, perhaps other than the Trump administration, which I think feels pretty good about where they are.
All right. Well, that was Jeremy Barr, media news reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks for joining us today, Jeremy.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we're going to talk with former Washington Post columnist Jennifer Rubin about leaving the Post and reporting on the Trump administration. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. A First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. One of the many ways the 2024 presidential election was unprecedented was the decision by major news outlets not to endorse a candidate for president. The major dailies breaking with tradition included The Washington Post and The LA Times. It was a decision resulting in the resignation of some longtime staffers. One of the most prominent and outspoken was longtime Washington Post columnist Jennifer Rubin, who is now editor-in-chief of the news site The Contrarian, which describes itself as an alternative, unflinching, unapologetic, unwavering in its commitment to truth-telling. Jennifer Rubin, welcome to All Sides.
It's nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
So we alluded it into the introduction, but can you tell us why you decided to resign from The Washington Post?
Well, it was both the decision to not endorse Kamala Harris and the decision, which quite frankly did not strike me as credible, that certainly played into it. But I think it's not only the Washington Post, but the media as a whole, and by media, I mean primarily corporate-owned, billionaire-owned media, has been far too willing to bend the knee, kiss the ring, accommodate itself to an administration that frankly is a threat to the free press, is a threat to democracy. And I think we've seen this in the capitulation of ABC to pay a giant settlement, the discussion that 60 Minutes CBS might do the same thing in an even more frivolous lawsuit, and the decision by media owners, including Jeff Bezos, to pay Donald Trump $1 million for his inauguration fund. And that kind of blurring of public and private interest and the refusal to robustly call out the administration for its attempts to intimidate the press, I think made it untenable for me to remain. So like many people, I have joined the wonderful world of independent media.
Yeah, we'll talk more about The Contrarian in a second, but I did want to ask you about Jeff Bezos' latest directive on the opinion section to embrace personal liberties and free markets. That led to the resignation of the opinions editor. What do you think of Jeff Bezos making this directive to the opinion section of The Washington Post?
Well, if he really believed that, he should have endorsed Kamala Harris. She is opposed to abortion restrictions. She's opposed to tariffs. She's opposed to crony capitalism. So these values clearly are not quite what he has in mind. So it's very curious what he plans on doing. After all, Donald Trump is the biggest threat to free markets that we've seen, at least in my lifetime, with his proposals for tariffs and his very personalized retaliatory direction of government. He's allowed someone with massive conflicts of interest to get into the nuts and bolts of government. And these kinds of actions are not indicative of free markets. And of course, free peoples, there's no greater danger to free peoples right now than Russia's grotesque, inhumane, genocidal invasion of Ukraine. And he shows no interest in stopping that. In fact, he seems to be buddying up to Putin. So I'm rather puzzled, frankly, by Mr. Bezos' statement. But more than that, major newspapers are not simply supposed to be spokesmen for their owners' corporate personal interests and views. The Washington Post in particular has always had a variety of views, left, right, center. The columnists have not always agreed with each other. And that's kind of been a calling card. That's what a responsible media outlet does, is it percolates and presents the best arguments it can find. And to some degree, you let the marketplace of ideas, there's that word again, marketplace of ideas, play out. And he clearly has something else in mind, which is simply to follow the Bezos line, whatever that might be. So I'm saddened by the development. Apparently another 75,000 subscriptions have been canceled. I fear this is the accelerated death of a great American newspaper.
I wanted to get your thoughts on a question we asked our first guest. He was a media professor. And do you feel that people need to look to the media to be the front line of resistance to the current administration? Do you think people are looking at the media like that? Or do you think that that's a part of what's missing, is that people, for the most part, don't care?
Well, I don't think it's the resistance. The media is supposed to be truth tellers, and they're supposed to say plainly what is in front of them. And right now we have one political party that's a rather normal political party, has different interests, different constituencies. It defends the institutions in which those politicians operate, whether it's a state governor, whether it's a member of Congress. And we have another that's a cult of personality, and that has largely given up on separation of powers, the rule of law, and the inability to distinguish those two and clearly articulate it is the great moral failing of the press today. Now, you can call that the resistance. I just call that truth telling and pretending that these two parties are the same, or pretending that Donald Trump is just another president, I think is grossly misleading. It's an abdication of their responsibility as journalists. And I think the reason that so many people have left is informed people don't want that. They don't want this pussyfooting around, this false equivalence. They want something that's clear, that's articulate, that lays out the facts and helps them make sense of the world.
Now, your new job that you have created, you're editor-in-chief of The Contrarian. So tell me, who is your audience? What are you hoping to do with The Contrarian?
Well, we hope the audience is broad. We hope the audience is really anyone who is interested in the most defining issue of our times, which is the battle between autocracy and democracy. We want to expand the audience of people who previously weren't, frankly, much interested in mainstream, so-called mainstream corporate media. We want to expand the age, the backgrounds of our viewers, and we're trying to do that by presenting different voices. We've also made a commitment, because you not only advance democracy through politics and law, but also through culture. And we're talking today on the first day of our new culture editor, who is joining the paper. We do humor, we do cooking, we do pets. And that's all part of presenting a wide offering to an audience. Some people may come for the pets and stay for the democracy. Other people may come for the legal analysis, but also be interested in film or art, and they'll stay for those as well. So we're really trying to speak to an entire community of Americans who are interested in this battle from whatever perspective, and are interested in hearing intelligent, clear voices.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the current media landscape with Jennifer Rubin, editor-in-chief of the news site The Contrarian. Now, you called it a paper, but I mean, it's a news site, right? You're not printing anything.
Correct, correct. Silly me. I still think in terms of, you know, newsprint and getting dropped on your doorstep. We are housed on Substack, which is one of the online platforms, but we are also on all social media. We're on YouTube. We are gearing up our podcast array. So really, anywhere in the non-traditional space, we hope to be. And we've only been up and running about 5 weeks or so, but the response has been just overwhelming. We are blown away by the number of people who want to subscribe, the number of people who tune in for our live chats 3 times a week, the number of people who join us for special event programming, such as the inauguration and President's Day. And I think there's a hunger for a real sense of community and to exchange ideas. People have felt very depressed, very isolated, very paralyzed. And one of the questions we get a lot is, what can we do? What can I do? And I think one of the things we can do is put on full display the variety of action that is going on around the country. We have an entire section that's just devoted to covering protests, rallies, town halls. And I think people sometimes feel like there's no one else out there who is in the same predicament. And that's certainly not the case.
Now, your partner at The Contrarian is former White House ethics czar Norm Eisen. Why did you decide to create your own this own startup instead of just when you left The Washington Post, you could have probably went to another news outlet?
That, as our tagline says, we're owned by nobody. We get to choose what we print. We get to choose our positions independent of other voices. We don't always agree with one another. We have a whole variety of contributors and people do disagree on various issues. But Norm is a very special person. He is not only the publisher of The Contrarian, but he is also one of the primary litigators out there filing lawsuits against Trump and Musk and Doge. And so he brings a particular insight and expertise in the legal area that I think people really want to hear from. He has given up his perch at CNN to devote almost all of his energies to litigation and to this new endeavor. But I think he's another person who saw that there was something missing in the corporate and the billionaire media. And I think there'll be more and more experiments like this. There are already some, and I certainly hope there are more.
Now, you mentioned your tagline, not owned by anybody. That's a pointed reference to billionaire Washington Post owner Jeff Bezos, but also, it kind of reminded me of public media's tagline of sorts. You know, we're funded by listeners who make contributions. So who is funding The Contrarian? How are you staying afloat?
Well, we are staying afloat. You can subscribe. $7 a month, $70 a year. You get a whole variety of offerings. The response has really been overwhelming. So we hope to build out that community even further.
Now, we're down to just about 2 minutes left, but I did want to ask you just quickly about the First Amendment. You know, it calls for a free press. So how concerned are you, especially with recent announcements by the White House about deciding who can participate in the press pool? What are you thinking about when you think about your career and the First Amendment?
It's really a horror show, and I'm a bit horrified, frankly, that the White House press corps has not reacted more strongly. We have two phenomenon going on. One is that the AP has been banned because it refuses to capitulate to the silly renaming of the Gulf of Mexico that Donald Trump wants. And as their editor said very eloquently on the Sunday shows, this is really about the government forcing people to use the language it wants. And there's nothing more injurious to the free press and to the First Amendment than that. And quite apart from that, they are trying to select which outlets get to cover them in the pool, which is a smaller group of journalists who operate in tight spaces, operate in the Oval Office, since obviously you can't have the entire press corps in there. And by selecting them, they are favoring certain voices that they think are going to be helpful to them and easy on them. And once again, that is an infringement on not only the free press, its ability to operate, but the First Amendment rights of Americans to hear that direct reporting. And I would hope that all media outlets realize that you can't just pick off one of them and everybody sit back and say, well, it's not me this time, or I'm still in the pool, or I didn't get banned. This is really a matter of fundamental purpose and principle. And I would hope that they all stick together and make their voices heard.
Thank you. That was Jennifer Rubin, editor-in-chief of The Contrarian. Thank you for joining us today, Jennifer.
My pleasure.
And thank you for joining us. This has been All Sides with Amy Jurevich on 89.7 NPR News.